You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So in today's episode, I'd like to talk about finding myself in an extremely left-leaning room over the weekend. So typically on the weekend, like, life to laze about at home, but my partner was like, you know what, we should go and do something wholesome. So we went to this event that had like a two-day event where they were having like lots of interesting talks. So there were lots of talks on like austerity as it is right now, on the inflation crisis. They were talking about imperialism. They were talking about freeing Palestine. They were talking about trans issues. They were talking about just issues affecting people's everyday lives. And you could basically like pay for your ticket and attend like three talks on one night. We only went for one of the days. We went for the Saturday, not the Sunday. And so the first talk we went to was on the subject was why the right is obsessed with gender and why they are obsessed with the trans movement. So, you know, I thought it sounds like an interesting conversation, and I'm really interested in trans issues, especially where they intersect with like women's rights in general. So to give you a bit of background in the room, just because I do think the demographics of the room matter, I would say probably the majority of the audience was like very young. I say very young, like I'm very old at this stage, but they're probably aged between 20 and 40, I would say, with the median age being around like 22, 23, I would say. So like super young people. And also like, I would say most people in there were very liberal, very left-leaning. With like, I noticed that slightly older people probably a bit more center left of the left leaning sphere. But anyway, so people start making comments, and you know, the comments are kind of not exciting. They feel very restrained. They feel very cautious and trepidatious. And they also kind of feel like they're like skimming the surface of the matter. Like it doesn't feel like anybody comes out with any like chunky comments or questions that the audience can really engage with. On top of that, I think I'm very sensitive to the temperature of rooms and to the temperature of like how people are behaving. Because one of the first things I pick up on is that people are clearly self-censoring and self-policing. And also there's like a silent form of collective policing of what people are saying or how people are phrasing things. And what I mean by that is sometimes like the policing in social settings isn't because somebody tells you explicitly, hey, what you just said that, like the room doesn't agree or we don't like that. Sometimes it's just in the fact that people kind of look at you sideways or they inhale or they just don't engage or there's no clapping or there's no interaction. It kind of tells you like, you know, without having to say so explicitly that they don't like what you're saying. What I noticed is that there just wasn't a lot of warmth and positivity in the room, and that felt like it was because people essentially weren't expressing themselves. So anyway, after like 20 minutes of this, where people were just kind of like making comments where they don't engage with the previous person's commentary, the host, who was also like the main speaker, basically like takes these questions and then makes like a conclusion speech. So incorporates like 10, 15 questions and comments that had been made, and then turns that into a speech where they address like most of those comments and then weave in their own opinions and thoughts about the things that had been discussed. So far, so good. Love audience participation in general, because it kind of feels like you're not just looking at the speaker for the full hour, like you're getting your thoughts out and you're also hearing from other people's contributions and thoughts, and that's always useful. Anyway, when the person starts speaking, I had this familiar feeling of feeling like I am the odd one out, because they started saying things where I was like, I don't know if the majority of people agree, because the way the person was speaking, it wasn't what they were saying, it's how they were saying it as well. The first thing I noticed was that they assumed that everybody agreed with what they were saying. And the second thing was they said in many different ways over the course of like the 20-25 minutes that they were concluding, like making the concluding remarks, basically the sentiment of like, the people who don't agree with us are against us and we should leave them by the wayside. Or they would say things like, they are going to be left by the wayside of history, or they're on the wrong side of history and history will erase them. And they like listed a couple of like prominent figures who've been like so-called canceled. And what I found interesting about that was that they were saying really extremist things that I don't think they realized were extremist. And I say this as an extremely left-leaning person who went to a very left-leaning liberal school. And one of the things they were saying, like over and over again, was that, for example, that sex is not real, that sex is a social construct. So we're all used to hearing about how gender is a social construct, and that is true. So for example, like the way that women behave as a group is not because they inherently, for example, on the tube, just cross their legs. It's because they've been socialized to believe that if they sit with their legs spread, they are not being ladylike. Or for example, the fact that a lot of like young women aspire to motherhood de facto is not necessarily just because their mothering instincts like kick in when they go through like a certain age. It's also because from their earliest times, like when they're young girls, they're given like prams and baby dolls to play with. And again, that's socializing them or nurturing them into believing that that's their natural course of life, or that's the natural course their life is going to take. So when in like gender discussions, people talking about social constructs, gender is being a social construct, I think most people agree 100%. And I also agree that there is a shackling effect that these gender norms have. People feel constrained. Like, for example, men feel like they're not men enough if they don't have a lot of money, or they feel like they're not men enough if they don't have like large like appendages, shall we say. So 100% agree, like there's nothing controversial about that. However, the sex being a social construct, or sex being immaterial, or sex not being real, that's the extremist part of the argument. Because what they are saying, and they were kind of going to like really farcical examples, they were making statements like, and like the majority of people cannot tell what sex a person is by looking at them. And that's categorically untrue. Most people, children included, can tell what sex somebody is, even when that person is presenting in like opposite clothes. You know what I mean? Secondly, they were saying that scientifically as well, that sex is a social construct, in that when they looked at the hormone profile of like 10,000 people, they could only predict or accurately tell the sex of the person in 8,000 of the 10,000 people. And again, I would say like, that's still saying that in 80% of the cases, you can tell people's sex based on their hormone profile. And even in those 2,000 people, I suspect that it's not because it's immaterial, it's because there's other things going on. So for example, like PCOS, when people have extreme forms of it, of course that is going to like show up in their hormones, and it's going to distort the way their hormonal profile reads, and that it's not going to neatly fit into either. However, clearly that's the exception. So all this to say is that part of the speech was really filled, like laden, like heavy-handed with a lot of this stuff, a lot of the stuff around sex being not real, sex being immaterial, sex being insignificant. And whilst many people agree that gender is a construct and also a constraint in many ways, the majority of people on earth do not agree that sex is immaterial, that sex is not real, for many, many reasons, one of them being just scientifically that's not true. And what, you know, those interactions in that room really made me feel or remind me of was just the nature of like virtue signaling in general. I feel like we're in a space where people kind of know what the right things to say and do are. So they know which virtues to perform and to signal. So in social settings, most people know the things that will get them like not canceled, but they're not going to get social props for them. So I'm unconvinced that when people are expressing these views in these spaces, sometimes I just wonder if they really mean what they're saying in their everyday life, or is it because we're in this particular space at this particular time that people feel like they have to kind of go along with the party line? And I say this because often or typically when people believe things through and through, it becomes self-evident, not just in the things that they're saying or like the virtue signaling that they're sort of putting out there. It's also self-evident in just like their everyday life. So for example, if somebody really believes in the value of multiculturalism, if somebody believes in having different friends from different places because cultural diversity matters, because racial diversity matters, because religious diversity matters, and it enriches people's lives, you will naturally see that in the people they date. You will see that in their social circle, in their friendship circle. So in other ways, like the virtue signaling is backed up by the fact that you just naturally see these things or these values reflected in their everyday life. With like the subject matter of the room that we were in, with like this sort of like a lack of responding to some of the claims that the speaker was making around sex being immaterial and not being real and as being a social construct, I don't know if the people in that room really believed that. And to be honest, I'm not even 100% convinced that they're truly trans allies. And I tell you why. Because I like to look at what people are doing, like I just said. So they'll be in these spaces, but for example, you'll go into their LinkedIn profiles and you'll notice that they don't actually make use of the gender pronouns like feature. Because you know, when you go into LinkedIn, you can basically put under your name, you can choose to put your gender pronouns. And that's sort of like a virtue signaling to other people that you are making it normal that people consider other people's pronouns, that you don't assume, that you make it a safe space for people to say, hey, actually, this is my pronoun, even if you might have gotten it wrong on basic instinct. So they won't do that. Or for example, like many companies now like suggest or prod that people use their gender pronouns in their email signature. But you'll see people who turn up to these events, but they won't change their email signature. Or a perfect example is this. In the US elections, just the last one that just happened, a lot of liberals, a lot of Democrats were like shaken, surprised, shocked at the way the vote went. And part of the reason why they were shocked is because there was an expectation that there was more consensus on some issues than there actually was. So people were showing up to these things and saying the right things, parroting the right things in public, whilst privately they clearly didn't believe those things. They clearly believed quite the opposite of things. And that's what that room made me feel like. It made me feel like, on the one hand, like the person who's speaking, the speaker, is winning in that moment, in that I guess they get to be the authoritative figure of what the group believes. But you can never really truly suppress people's true feelings, because either they express those feelings in that room, in that public domain, and people have a chance to like change their views, to give them information they might not have considered, to give them insights they might not have considered, and make them really like consider their opinion and potentially change their opinions. Either that space is given to them, or they just go away and they become more entrenched in their views. And instead of having like that discourse with people who actually have like information that could sway them, or instead of having like human contact, because often actually what changes people's opinions is knowing somebody personal who is knowing somebody personally who's affected by the thing that is just like a theoretical thing to them. So for example, a lot of people who are homophobic until they have like a gay son or daughter, and then they start to see it through the human lens, and through that exposure and like having love for their child and having discussions with their child and maybe like other people in their child's circle who are also like gay or trans, their opinions change because they're kind of, the issue's humanized for them, and it's not just sort of like a theoretical thing. So unfortunately, in that space, I genuinely just felt like they lost an opportunity to have an open discussion, because the host was so like committed to like so committed to misreading the silence. And to me, the silence was so loud. Like, it was like a loud, you know, sometimes the silence is just in your head. Like, sometimes, like, when you're sensitive to something, it feels like a bigger deal to you and you recognize that. So for example, there are certain subjects when they come up, I feel really uncomfortable and I don't want to be in that space, but I'm perfectly aware that other people are enjoying that talk or that space and it's not affecting them. In this particular example, let me tell you, the silence was deafening. Clearly the person, I mean, it's very possible that they didn't have good social cues as well and they didn't know how to respond to the cold room. But to me, it was just quite an obvious example of people using their silence strategically and the people who organized it, like, misreading that silence for support, you know, because it's almost like what the host wanted the most is people not to dissent. And even if they didn't get like a round of ovation or claps, they didn't mind insofar as people didn't like dissent. They didn't say things they didn't like. So they were kind of happy to take that silence as sort of like support, which just is not true. Like, silence often is unexpressed opinions, obviously. And often it means that the audience is not with you. Otherwise, they're very happy to express like support, you know. In group settings, people are very happy to clap and whoop and like cheer on when they hear something they like, because it's kind of like their only way of expressing themselves in that sort of setting, that, you know, they can't stand up and say, I agree, but they will clap to let you know they like what you said. So in this particular case, clearly people didn't like what was being said. And this is in a room that's very left-leaning. This is in a room of people who chose or elected to be there in the first place, knowing what the subject matter was and having propensity to be more left-leaning. And one of the things that it made me think of, other than just sort of like how silence is such a powerful indicator that we shouldn't ignore, the other thing it made me think of was just intersectionality politics. Like, we need to go back to that. The idea that people can like be aligned in terms of like the goals that they share and they can form a coalition around those goals. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the group's like interests throughout aren't going to clash, and sometimes that those interests aren't going to be mutually exclusive. So in other words, it's perfectly possible to be in one sense a victim and then in another sense be an oppressor within a coalition or within like a group of allies. And a perfect example is sort of that we think about or used to hear, I guess, is around feminism. So for example, like women as a group are united in that there is a structural disadvantage that they face, in that, for example, 90% of all land and wealth is in the hands of men. Like, that's globally. And so women are united around that goal of redistributing that wealth and land so that it's more egalitarian, so that it's 50-50 as it should be. However, in that pursuit of that goal, it doesn't mean that within the in-group, within the female group, the woman group, that there aren't going to be like power dynamics at play that are also worth addressing that may undermine the overall goal if left unaddressed. One of those causes, of course, is the idea of racism within feminism. The idea that although women of color are aligned with white women in feminism, that doesn't mean that the women of color don't realize or recognize that in other contexts, white women form part of their oppressors, in the sense that, of course, white women are also subject to the patriarchy, but it's not as though they are not beneficiaries of racism. And also not just like passive beneficiaries, but active participants historically and now. Like, one of the things I often think about is Emmett Till. And Emmett Till, as many of you might know, was murdered in the 1960s because he was down south. I forget exactly which state he was, but he'd been sent by his mother to stay with like family members. And he was standing in front of a shop and he, you know, just watching the day go by and his cousin buying something in the shop. And a white woman passed by and she alleged that he whistled at her. And she goes home and she tells her husband that this black boy, this African-American boy, obviously they would have called them something different back then, whistled at her. And at that time, that was like the height of disrespect for a black man or a black boy or black people to have to look at white people, to make eye contact with them, or to show any sort of like any sort of disrespect or any sort of behavior that could be interpreted as disrespect. So she goes home and tells her husband that this boy whistled at her, basically like flirted with her or insinuated like sexual desire for her. What happens to Emmett Till is he is kidnapped from his home. He is tortured and he is mutilated and he is killed. They shoot him in the head. So that's an example clearly of a white woman using her social power, her power within the racist structure, to the demise of a black person. So in that situation, they clearly are the oppressors. In modern times, by the way, that theme of like white women weaponizing like their sexual vulnerability, quote unquote, it, like, still goes on today. Like, one of the things I think about is about Chris Brown. And Chris Brown, you know, I feel bad to take up for him. But with Chris Brown, a few years ago, there was a woman who alleged that he raped her. And she said that they went to a party and he sexually assaulted her, sexually violated her. Her friend, like seeing like what was happening to Chris Brown, comes out with text messages that shows that the girl who had alleged rape had basically done it, like it was a lie, first of all, and she had done it because he hadn't given her access to this club. So he had left her out of like the list of people to be included, and he basically didn't want her basically. And so as revenge, she alleged that he had raped her, knowing, of course, that the law was going to be more on her side, being a white woman who's alleging something against a black man. Now, luckily in this situation, like, the woman stepped forward and said, yeah, this woman is lying. These are the text messages. This is her telling, like, laughing about how she's going to get him in trouble and she was going to get her revenge. Again, that's an example of white women weaponizing racism and oppressing black people. So going back to the feminism discussion, clearly white women are victims as other women under patriarchy, but within the context of the group, we can't pretend as though they don't have significantly more power and that that power isn't used for bad. And so intersectionality is the idea that you can be united around a goal, but still assess or analyze the power dynamics within the group. Otherwise, basically, you're creating a situation where the people who are already oppressed by you have to shut up and put up because you kind of have this power over them in some way. Another example of sort of like the complexities of coalition around a goal, but still having power dynamics within the group, is when you consider the power dynamics within the LGBT umbrella itself. So you have a situation in which, like, clearly LGBT people are united around the goal of getting liberation in terms of not being harassed, not being persecuted, not being criminalized for their sexual orientation. So clearly united on that front and on that goal. But within the LGBT umbrella, clearly there are going to be power dynamics, especially because there's so many different people coming together. One of the power structures or the power struggle is the recognition that whilst gay men are oppressed by the patriarchy that they themselves, you know, participate in and create, They're oppressed by society because of their sexual orientation, but we can't pretend as though they don't benefit from the patriarchy as well, being men. So that is evident, for example, in just like the accessibility that they have in terms of like leisure places of leisure. So go to any large city and what you will notice is that the gay scene will always be dominated by gay men's activities. So they'll have plenty of bars, especially in a city like London where I live. There are so many bars for gay men. There are so many clubs for gay men. There are so many events and venues catering exclusively to gay men. But for women, for lesbians or bisexual women or women who only want to be in female spaces, literally, it's like a ratio of like 10 to 1. They probably have like 10% of what the gay men have. And that isn't just because like gay men like to go out more and women prefer to stay in. It's also because the men control the capital and they're able to invest in these spaces. They're able to determine if there is a club, is it going to be a club that caters to women or is it going to be a club that caters to men? They're going to have the money to be able to create their own spaces in a way where women who have significantly fewer resources, like monetary resources, financial wealth, like inherited wealth, they're not going to be able to invest in their community in the same way. That's another example of like being aligned around a goal, but that coalition also having power structures within it, which can sort of compromise the overall goal if those power dynamics aren't addressed.
I think another thing to recognize is that like sometimes people assume that just because you like support the same outcomes, that you're supporting those outcomes for the same reasons, when it's very possible and often is the case that people, for example, can vote with you, but they're voting based on a different rationale. And sometimes that rationale matters a lot. This makes me think a lot about like in comedy, like I love comedy. I love going to comedy shows. And my favorite comedian is Dave Chappelle. And with Dave Chappelle, which BTW, I saw him in London, like when he was here last, which was, I think was a year and a half ago. And he completely bombed. Like he did terribly. He was like high. He was like underprepared. And even at the beginning of the night, he said something like, I've got a feeling I'm going to bomb. And he really did. But one other thing about Dave Chappelle comedy, for anybody who likes Dave Chappelle's comedy, you will know that he appeals to a very wide audience, both black, white, and other people. And sometimes when people are laughing at the joke, I don't know if you've had this feeling where you just realize in that moment that you're both laughing, but you're laughing for like really different reasons. And that's one of the things that conflicts me with Dave Chappelle comedy, in that I find him hilarious, but I also think he makes a lot of socially irresponsible commentary, especially that show, like the Dave Chappelle Show, which I might do an episode on in the future. So sometimes when you're laughing, like you're in a hall full of people, you're all laughing together. And you, for example, as a black woman, might be laughing at like something about the black experience that he has been able to just like point out something you never noticed or thought about in the way that he's presenting it to you, and you're laughing at how outrageous or funny, or laughing in a self-deprecating way, or laughing at that recognition of like this shared thing that you have. But that's not to say that other people who don't share that characteristic are laughing at it for the same reason. Like sadly, sometimes they're laughing because they agree with the trope, but not in the same way that you're agreeing. Like they're laughing sometimes at the fact that the person making the joke, especially when it's like a racialized joke, they're laughing because a black person, for example, is making a racist joke against black people, and they're enjoying the fact that it's being said out loud, because then that person can be like, oh, I knew it was true, or it's refreshing that they're saying something that I already believed or people around me have said. So again, like you're both laughing at the same joke, but it's coming from a radically different place. I think that's also the case when it comes back to what we were talking about, like in reference to being aligned on the goals, or being in a coalition or in a movement or an organization where you have shared goals, but your rationale or your reasons for that goals are very different. So with the trans movement, for example, like people who support the trans movement, myself included, I think believe wholeheartedly, obviously, that trans people have a right as adults with agency to live in the bodies and in a way where they feel comfortable in their skin. They believe also that like social respect and dignity and politeness should be extended to them in the same way that it's extended to lots of other people. So when it comes to things like pronouns, for example, people make such a big fuss out of them. Like it takes a lot to say them or to respect people's new name and to be polite and respectful and not use people's like dead names or former names. But that social nicety or social like politeness, like we literally do that in lots of other examples. For example, in the context of religion, most people who aren't religious will refer to a priest as father, or will refer to a nun as mother, especially if she's like a senior nun. Like I went to a Catholic girls' school and for my primary school, and
literally everybody called them father, like mother, and other like religious like terms that people who aren't religious don't necessarily believe that those people have those like titles in real life, but they still extend that social grace. In other contexts, like even when we refer to people as like doctors, like when people have PhDs and we call them doctors, or in the context of like classrooms, like people, children, even like adult learners will call like the teacher sir or madam. It's not necessarily that you believe, for example, that the PhD person deserves your respect and deserves to be called doctor. It's just that you know that it's a polite thing to do. Like people work very hard to get their PhDs, and one of the benefits of getting a PhD, aside from the knowledge and the career prospects and all that, is that you get to be called doctor and referred to in that respectful tone. So we just sort of acquiesce. Or even in terms of like closer to name changes, like people change their names. Like for example, when people get married, they'll adopt a surname, a new surname, and you will just call them by their new surname. Sometimes people don't even like get that name legally changed, but they informally adopt like their husband's name typically, and people will change how they refer to them. Or in the context of nicknames, like a lot of people have nicknames, and people, even though they know that's not their legal name, will still go along with that because that's what the person wants, and it literally doesn't cost us anything. So going back to the pronouns and addressing people by their preferred names and not using their dead names, all those things are very small concessions that we make in other areas all the time as well anyway. That's not a big deal. I will say though, like where the line starts to delineate between where there really is that consensus that we agree on these basic tenets of why we support the trans movement, the line delineates when it goes into the realm of the kind of fringe, or I would say radical aspects of some of the rhetoric that's used. So some of the stuff that I referred to at the top of the episode, when the host was talking about how everybody in the room believed that sex is not real, that it is immaterial, that it is not scientific, you know, again, like when it gets to that part, I think they're assuming that even though we still support the trans movement, they're kind of assuming that we're in agreement about those things. And sometimes it's down to, I don't know if I want to describe it as like moral cowardice or a lack of courage to like express yourself, but sometimes people believe these things because literally, as was like in that room, people didn't verbalize what they were really thinking. Like the silence was deafening, as I said, but it's not as though somebody said, hang on a second, obviously these are the areas in which we agree, but when you start going into this realm of discussion, specifically around the immateriality of sex, or the fact that sex is not real, or the idea that sex is not real, we are not in agreement, and let's see how we can square that circle. So part of the reason why there is sort of that radical presence or fringe presence is also part of like all of our silence, or all of our like lack of courage in being able to say what we feel, and saying it in a compassionate, kind way, not in a confrontational, ugly way, but saying it in terms of why it is that we don't agree that that's true, and what the implications of what the person is saying. And going back to that room when like the host was speaking and they were saying all these stuff, like they said plenty of stuff that most people agree with, but they said a lot of stuff that was like very fringe, as I said. And what I felt in that space, and I'll go back to the demographics, what I felt in that space, I think I felt it as one, a woman, and two, as a Black woman. So as a Black woman, I definitely felt I'm in an all-white space where a white person is basically telling the group, and by implication me, that if I am not with them, I am against them. If I don't 100% agree with some of the rhetoric and some of the analysis around the trans movement, then I'm basically like going to be left by the wayside. I'm on the wrong side of history. And that's already a disorientating feeling in a way. Secondly, I was feeling it from the perspective of being a woman. And I was thinking about all the various ways in which sex affects my life. I've already talked about just like from a macro level, just like the inequality in income and wealth and inherited wealth distribution, where you can literally look it up. 90% of all land and
resources are in the hands of men. So automatically, even from a macro level, I know that sex clearly matters. From a personal level, like as a woman, obviously I know that sex is not immaterial. Not only is it codified in every single cell of my body. So for example, like sometimes you literally, during periods of the month, you don't have control over your emotions. I don't know if you've ever had the experience where you, in the moment, are completely committed to the emotion that you feel. And that emotion often is, unfortunately, like negative emotion. Maybe you're cranky, maybe you're moody, maybe you're short-tempered, maybe you're feeling more teary, maybe you're feeling more anxious. And in that moment, during that like cycle, you don't realize that actually your hormones are having an impact on you. But after those hormones have left your body or have dissipated, or that you're in a different part of your cycle, you can literally look back at what you a few days was like and the thought processes that you had and the things that you felt and the things that you said and the way that you looked at life or a situation or a moment or your partner, because they often are the receivers of that behavior. You will realize that you are being ruled by your emotions. So even on a basic everyday like minutia level, your hormones affect how you feel to the point where you're not even in control of your own mind. And that's to say nothing of the fact that you bleed once a month or the fact that you are vulnerable to getting pregnant. That's to say nothing of all the different things that affect you physically from your sex. So clearly it isn't immaterial. And to be honest, like even from a cost perspective, like your period costs you money. Like you have to buy tampons and pads and painkillers and those stuff. Those things aren't cheap. Like look at the prices of Tampax. If you buy like a light, because obviously most people, you'll go through different parts of your cycle. So you're not just going to have one weight. You're going to have the light, the medium and the heavy. You might have pads as well as backup. You might have night pads if you want like those extra long ones. And then on top of that, you buy painkillers. And I like to buy like really strong painkillers because my cramps can be really bad on day two. So like you're probably spending like 15 pounds probably every month. Add that up over the course of the year. That's not immaterial. Other stuff is just in terms of like safety. When you look at the stats on sexual violence, you will notice that 95% of victims of sexual violence are women at the hands of men, typically. And when you consider sexual violence, it literally is based on your sex. It isn't based on how you present. It isn't based on your gender expression. It isn't based on whether you are like feminine presenting or androgynous presenting or butch presenting. Specifically, what the violator wants is the fact that you have the female sex. And so it's obviously very material. And again, even going back to the gender expression, it isn't even based on your sexual orientation. It's not like violators look at you and they're like, oh well, you're a bisexual woman, so maybe I'll consider violating you, but you're a gay woman. So they don't see any of those things. 99% of the time they know that you're a female and they attack you on the basis of the fact that you are female. So obviously sex is a very material concern for women, and on a day-to-day basis, when you do feel afraid as a woman, most of the time, or uncomfortable or wary, typically it's around men, and typically it's because you fear what they might do to you, and they only target you because you're a woman. And so obviously as a woman, you know, who's had lots of experiences of predatory men, like at various levels, like trying to do things, like even I was literally just talking about this yesterday, actually, about this guy. I get off at the same train station for work on most days, and there's this man, like, part of it, I blame myself because I wasn't robust or harsh enough with him the first time. But he has come up to me like 7-8 times. Each time he comes up to me, I say, I'm not interested, but thank you. And I start to move and he follows me. And I usually stop and I engage in like polite conversation, but basically to say, listen, I'm flattered, which I'm not, but I'm not interested. And the more times he's approached me, the more, not aggressive, because he doesn't have like bass in his voice or he's not intimidating like where he's standing over me, but in his sheer persistence and in the fact that he follows me from like the station to my bus stop already tells me that he's an unsafe person. So the final time, the last interaction I had with him was the worst one,
where he followed me from the train station, and instead of going to the bus stop, because I knew my bus wasn't coming for another 10 minutes, I decided to tell him in front of like this M&S, like this shop, that I wasn't interested. And I kind of said it very firmly. I said, I'm not interested. And please stop following me. And I went into the shop because I obviously people are there. And I also thought I could kill some time and hopefully he will go away. That doesn't happen. He follows me into the store, follows me around. And I consider asking staff for help, but I couldn't see anybody. So I decide to walk quickly out of the shop to see if I can lose him. When I come out of the shop, he's still behind me. So then instead of going to the bus stop, I decide to go back to the train station because there's lots of people there and there are staff there. When I enter the station, he's still following me, like following me, not saying anything. And I stop, I turn around, and he is continuing to walk towards me. And I say, listen, I've told you a million times I'm not interested. And at this point, I start to shout, actually, like The Gift of Fear. I don't know if you've read the book by Gavin DeBecker. Like The Gift of Fear came into, and I just realized at that moment I had been underestimating how much of a danger this person is. So I, at that point, I start shouting loudly, like, leave me alone. I've told you a million times I'm not interested. Stop following me. And I'm saying it loud enough where everybody's like looking at me, and the staff are like contemplating coming over to like see what's going on. Like the whole thing probably lasts like 30 seconds. He starts like back away from me, and then he walks out of the store and walks out of the train station, sorry. And I see him go off into the distance. And then when I go home, when I wait like 5 minutes to make sure that he's gone, and then I'm literally running to the bus stop. And luckily I'd called my partner to pick me up, so I got into the car and was able to get out of there. But that's an everyday example of just this sort of like harassment that can turn dangerous, that women all the time face. And that's not like, that's a recent example, but I've had very other similar things where people, for example, just because I've got a bit of time, I get the taxi to the train station most mornings, which is kind of a bad habit of mine. And I got into a taxi, like I usually get it at about 6 a.m. or between 6 and 6:10. So I get into a taxi, and there's like this guy who's talking to me, and I'm chit-chatting in the morning as you do. And he drops me off, I think nothing of it. The next day I go to order a taxi, and I order it, and within like 10 seconds, somebody has accepted the taxi. So I get into the taxi, not thinking anything of it, just thinking, obviously, there just happened to be a taxi that was coming around the corner. I get into the car, and surprise, surprise, it's the guy from the day before. It's the same driver that had me the day before. And at that point, I don't know why, maybe it's because I was in a rush, but I just thought it was a coincidence. I just thought he obviously does this route all the time. He obviously starts working at the same time. And I honestly didn't think much of it beyond thinking like, oh, like that's quite weird. I've never had the same driver before, which is the only reason why it stood out. The next day I get my taxi, and I had that, before I even ordered the cab, I knew in my heart, I knew in my spirit that it was going to be the same man. I woke up even when I woke up that day, that morning, I got up at early as usual, and I just knew, even before I'd ordered the taxi, before I'd showered, before I'd gotten dressed, I just knew that he was going to be there again. Not because he'd done anything sinister or sexual or perverse in the taxi. I don't know how I knew, I just knew. Maybe it's because, you know, he'd already done it, you know, the first time. So again, I order the taxi. Within like 30 seconds, the taxi is accepted. I recognize the reg, not the reg, but the face, because you know you get the icon on Bolt. It's like an alternative to Uber here in London. So I recognize that it's the same person, and I just get in the taxi because he's already outside my door, which is why, by the way, you should always put the address a few doors down, because now I also felt like I had to get into taxi because he already knew where I lived anyway, and I didn't want to make it weird. So because now it's happened 3 days in a row, I realize this guy wakes up, like parks outside my house, waits for me to order the taxi. Like really, really, really creepy. So going back to the immateriality of sex, that stalker, both those stalkers, are not following me on the basis of my gender expression. They're following on the basis of my sex. And whilst it might be something that men or male-bodied people don't appreciate or don't recognize because that's not their experience, except for maybe like gay men who get harassed, for example, when they hold hands, or trans women who get harassed when they're walking in the street, when they're visibly like trans, outside of that, typically, I don't think they understand the level to which it's deeply ingrained into our everyday lives, into our everyday existence. And so as a woman in that space, in that talk, hearing this male-bodied person talk about how sex is immaterial, how it's not real, how it's a social construct, how it doesn't matter. Of course, I have those experiences in my mind and many other experiences, really. And I also know for a fact that the other women in that space also have had very similar experiences because sadly, it's just a part of life. Like my partner was telling me about how two women every week in the UK are killed. It's just femicide and violence against women is just a normalized part of our existence. But what is also a normalized part of our existence is the willful ignorance of men, like so-called good men, of that fact. And to be honest, like, I don't even necessarily blame them. Like, in the society that we live in, it's kind of like a natural outcome or a foregone conclusion in many instances, or in, I would even say in the majority of cases, that most men are going to have like that amnesia, that collective amnesia, or that collective unseeing of what happens to women in their everyday life. I actually have an episode on this topic, season 2, episode 20, I think it is, where I talk about how we all participate, particularly men, in upholding the sexist society that we live in. So in that context, in the fact that most men are socialized to turn a blind eye to everyday sexism, to turn a blind eye to the subjugation of women. They live in a society that not only like turns a blind eye to like rape culture or rapiness in general, but that kind of in many respects like presents it as being admirable. So think, for example, of like storylines that revolve around women not being interested in the man and the man being like, I'm gonna work my hardest to like turn her around or to like get her to change her mind. And she will have said no in many ways, like, I'm not interested, I don't have feelings for you. And then the story arc is that she comes around, like he wins her around. It's like she didn't know that she liked him until he convinced her, you know, like the idea that she needs to be convinced, the idea that the first 1, 2, 3, 4 no's aren't no's, but they're basically an invitation to pursue. So like a lot of us, most of us are socialized in that culture as are men. And so like whether you transition or not doesn't absolve you from that socialization. Like we literally cannot opt out of that socialization because it isn't just about self-identity. It's also how people perceive you and how they treat you. So in my mind, I might feel like I'm X, Y, and Z. That doesn't necessarily mean that the way that the world is interacting with me is on that basis. And because many people as well don't transition until their adult years, it means that they've had a lifetime of being socialized in that body, in that way, as that person. So in the same way that I'm socialized to sort of like be nice to men who wish me harm, they are socialized to think that the harm they're causing is either not harm or that it's not that much harm. And that can manifest like those opposing ways of being socialized show up in these types of discussions and this type of discourse and in those types of spaces just organically in the form or in the way in which different people approach the same conversation, and those different approaches are based on their own personal backgrounds and how they have been socialized. And so even though they may be in the same space because they support the same cause, it doesn't mean that the power dynamics in that room mean that they're both on the same playing field or in the same it doesn't mean that they're coming at things from the same perspective. And this rapiness or this rape culture or like this socialization to sort of be predatory with women like shows up in LGBT spaces when you think about like discussions around the cotton ceiling, which is the idea that lesbians or women who only date women like are intolerant of trans women because they don't sleep, like they may support trans causes and they may be welcoming of trans women into like female spaces. So for example, like most like lesbian events definitely accommodate like trans women. So they say that although that accommodations made space is made for them in those spaces, like at events or bars or clubs or other non sort of like drinking events, shall we say, or non nightlife events, when it comes to the personal, there is that boundary that trans women face. And the issue with that is, I mean, first on a basic level, like women are allowed to say they don't want to sleep with anybody. And that should be the end of the question. Like, it shouldn't be a situation where lesbians are being prodded into a corner and to feel like they are being villainous or villains if they say they only like to have sex with women. Because one, that's just their right. And second, it's kind of homophobic to assume that lesbians aren't attracted to the sex part of womanhood. You know, like that's kind of like what it's implying. It's kind of implying that it's about the trappings of femininity or womanhood that lesbians are attracted to. So if you like wear makeup or present as female or like female interests, then that in itself is the overrides the other things. Well, actually, clearly that's not true because one, like women, lesbians, bisexual women, they present in all kinds of ways. There's like feminine women, there's in the middle women, there's tomboy women, there's androgynous women, there's butch women, there's stud women. They present in all kinds of ways. And even when you go to like the side of presenting more masculine, quote unquote, the reason why the women will be attracted to like butch women or androgynous women or stud women and not attracted to men is because clearly what they're attracted to is the sex part of that woman. You know, otherwise, if they are presenting as masculine, you would assume that they would also be attracted to men because men also present that way or versions of that, shall we say. And if they're not attracted to them, it means that what they're attracted to is the sex part of that woman. Obviously, they find all kinds of women attractive, but the thing that unites the attraction or the thing that they all share in common is the fact that those women are attracted to the sex part of womanhood. Like their orientation is to find people of that sex desirable, attractive, to find them sexually desirable, romantically desirable. It's kind of like when people, like homophobic people, say to lesbians, like for lesbians who use like sex toys like dildos, well, if you will take penetration from a dildo, why wouldn't you take penetration from a man? And the point of that is, well, that's kind of implying that the man would be happy to receive oral sex from any mouth. Presumably, it's not just about the warm mouth, it's who's doing it to you as well. So if they are a straight man, presumably they don't want to be, they don't want oral sex performed on them by other men. They want they are attracted by the fact that it's a woman who's performing that act. Same with like other things. So with a caught in the ceiling, you know, again, I say it's homophobic from that basic premise in that there's a denial that women are sexually minded, that they have a sexual attraction to women, and that the physicality of a woman is material, to use a word I've probably used a million times in this episode. Like, it's not incidental, it's material, it's central to the sexual attraction. And this is not to speak of people who are like romantically attracted, I forget what the term is, people who are attracted to somebody romantically or because of their personality and then they become sexually attracted to them. Like those people can actually be like pansexual or bisexual, because what they're saying is it's not about the physicality of the person, it's about the other components of them, you know. And you know, we have all these other terms, but loosely speaking, they're in the bisexuality camp. In the lesbian camp, the women are attracted to the other women because of their sex, because they're sexually orientated to prefer or to exclusively want to sleep with women. And so going back to the room that I was in where that person was talking about like the immateriality of sex, like one of the things that I think often about is the fact that people kind of can have these theoretical discussions that kind of feel like they are ignorant of the real life like consequences or implications of what they are saying. And to me, like a parallel example that kind of shows this, like outside the trans discussion that shows this, is discussions around like transracialness. I know it didn't take off or hasn't taken off really. But I forget what summer it was. I feel like maybe it was like 2018. It was definitely pre-pandemic. It was when the world found out about like Rachel Dolezal, who was this woman who had been living for years as a Black woman, but she was in fact a white woman. So at this point, she was actually the head of the NAACP chapter in her local area, like the local chapter. So she'd gone up the ranks. She was a lecturer, I believe, as well, who taught on, if not critical race theory, then something to like either like Black American studies or African American studies, something to that effect. So head of the NAACP, like the local chapter, was also a lecturer or a professor on like a race related matter. And with the Rachel Dolezal scandal, like how she was discovered that she was actually living a lie was that somebody, she had, this is actually really brazy, she had been filing police reports about like racial attacks that she'd experienced or like racial or racialized terrorism that she'd experienced. So she had said that people, that she didn't know who it was, people were posting nooses through her letterbox or her mailbox. So she'd found like these nooses and these messages that were like, were using the N-word, and they were basically threatening her. And so the police investigated, and what they found was that she had been posting the nooses in her own mailboxes, or put another way, she'd been faking the racial, like the racial attacks or the racial targeting. And on top of that, like when people, like when journalists were like hounding the people that she knew and she, like her colleagues and people in her life, you know, what they said was that they always felt like something was off, but they just couldn't quite figure out what it was. And Rachel really went like to extreme lengths to prove her Blackness or to like present herself as Black. An example of this is, she used this Black man, she like posted his picture and basically said that that Black man was her father, even though her father is like the whitest of white men. She also used her adopted siblings and used them as though they were her children. So she's got her family, her parents adopted like Black children, I think it's two. They adopted two black children, and she basically would post pictures implying that those children were hers. And also, like, you know, she like basically wore blackface, like she like darkened her skin with like tanning and with makeup. She like changed her hair texture. Her like natural hair texture is like blonde and very, very straight. And she clearly would like get a perm, and she would like backcomb it, and she would like try to make it look fluffy and sort of like Afro-like. And she also like dyed it dark brown. So she clearly like went the full hog in committing to this identity. But what I think, like, Rachel Dolezal, like, what the experience with the scandal, what the, like, I'm sure hundreds of articles that was written about the scandal really demonstrates is, like, so many parallels with the things that Rachel said about how she felt about her identity and how she came to identify as Black. There's so many parallels with the language that she appropriated from the trans movement and the language she was using to justify her actions. One of the things she said was that she could adopt Blackness because Blackness was a social construct. And again, like on the face of it, it is true that Blackness is a social construct in the sense that people have been racialized. Like, so for example, like when you're a Black person in an African country, you're not Black, you're just a person. When you're an African person in a white country, you are a Black person. And the only thing that's changed is that you are in two different locations with different construction of what it means to be a person who has your skin tone. So in the white world, like through eugenics, through like historical, like I would say like mythologies around Blackness and through the things they've had to create, like the myths around Blackness that they had to create to justify the things that they've done to Black people or to African people, to dark skinned people, they have taken on a construction of what it means to be Black. In the white world, unfortunately, you know, most of it is negative. Like they've really pathologized every element of our existence, but it has a very particular meaning. It is not inherent, it's a construction. Like people behave in particular ways, not because they inherently like those things, but because they've been socialized to be that way. And it's not just like somebody playing you a particular type of music and saying, hey, listen, like all Black people like this kind of music. It's contextual and situational. So For example, like you will find that a lot of black women in the white world will wear like wigs, but not wigs of like their own hair texture, wigs of like other ethnicities, whether it's like Brazilian or Indian or European, it'll be like that kind of textured hair. And you see it all the time and you might think like, oh, well, maybe black people just like wearing those types of wigs. But obviously it's very historically specific, and actually like specific in the modern times as well, in that African-American or African or black hair type literally has been criminalized in all kinds of ways. Even today, there are schools that literally will send you home if you show up with hair that isn't straight or hasn't been straightened, or hair that is adorned or presented in like African type hairstyles. Like, and there's, it's kind of like become like criminalized now in all kinds of ways, like the schools who did this, but they still do that. Like, so for example, if you show up in locks or show up in dreads or if you show up in braids, like there are students who are sent home or penalized or told to come back with a different hairstyle. So people who are socialized in that context, you know, it's kind of natural or expected or not like shocking that they would grow up and sort of adopt European or what, like non-black hairstyles in the form of like wigs and weaves, etc., because their experience has been that literally their blackness has been criminalized. Like, they couldn't show up in spaces and not be like negatively impacted by just showing up as they are. So in terms of like race as a social construct, it's like a micro example of things that people do that's an outcome of the society that they live in, but it's not inherent. It's because of that socialization that has taken place. So like that's the first parallel with the gender like discourse, like the arguments in favor of supporting the trans movement. The second thing is around is the parallels between like gender dysphoria and racial dysphoria. So Rachel Dolezal spoke about the dysphoria she experienced being a white person who grew up in a white household in which she witnessed racist parents being racist towards like their black siblings that they had adopted, but also just in general being racist people, and also living in a wider society or culture in which she just didn't feel like white culture like represented her values. She didn't want to be associated with them. She didn't want to be associated with their past, with the things that they did, and also in the things that they currently did to people of color, specifically black people. And so she had this inherent sense of alienation and a sense of not feeling comfortable in her body and showing up in the world as she was, because obviously as a white woman, when she showed up into these spaces, people would assume that she also, you know, is part of the dominant culture and probably has the dominant culture's values. And she basically wanted to distance herself from that. It made her feel uncomfortable. It made her feel ashamed. It made her feel isolated, and insert like all the adjectives that pertain to that kind of emotion, that kind of like conflict, that kind of internal conflict. So she didn't term it as like racial dysphoria, but like in terms of what she was describing, she was basically describing that feeling of that dysphoric feeling. So that's the second parallel. The other parallel was just the identification and like the affinity with something that you are not or something that you have never experienced. So Rachel said that she always felt that she was black, that from like the earliest years of her life, from when she was a child, she didn't feel white. She felt like she wasn't white, and she was like having to pretend to be white, but she always felt that she was black. She felt black because she appreciated black music. She appreciated black food. She appreciated black culture. She felt an affinity with the black people. She felt a connection with black people. And she herself felt black. Like the things she gravitated to, the things that she enjoyed, how she felt spiritually and psychologically and mentally, she felt like a black person trapped in a white person's body. And so again, like, you know, the parallels between the kinds of arguments that Rachel Dolezal was making share a great deal with the rationale or the discourse in the trans movement. And obviously we know like what happened with the Rachel Dolezal story. Like, black people were, you know, unequivocal in what they said, that transracialness was not
a thing, or it was not accepted, was she was not welcome, there was no concessions made to her or towards her. But imagine if she, if concessions had been made, imagine if we had accepted transracialism. Like, even if we accepted like Rachel's like dysphoria, discomfort, isolation, maybe even depression and being trapped in a body that she inherently felt like didn't represent her, and in fact like bound her to a group of people that she felt ashamed of, or she felt like she didn't want representing her, we would still have to have very defined boundaries around that acceptance of her as a Black person, or that acceptance of transracialism, for like many reasons. One of those reasons is what I talked about in my earlier segment, in that even under the trans umbrella, if it did include transracialism, like the power dynamics would still be at play. Ultimately, you couldn't ignore the fact that Rachel Dolezal was able to get to the top of the NAACP organization as a result of her whiteness. Like, it's like colorism is a thing. Like, the propensity to give lighter-skinned people or people with a proximity to whiteness greater opportunities and greater leadership roles is pretty well documented. And so her, as like a very light-skinned, quote-unquote Black person, partly, I'm sure, advanced because of that, like on that basis. I also think it's impossible to ignore the fact that clearly her socialization played a role in how she went about like embracing or adopting this identity, in that on the one hand, she was adopting Blackness and she was presenting herself as a Black person, and she was presenting herself as a trans, no, she wasn't presenting herself as a transracial person, she was just presenting as Black. Her socialization comes into play because even in her Blackness, she couldn't, one, like stop being racist, in the sense that, again, when they interviewed people who she worked with, who she taught, they said that basically experienced like loads of microaggressions from her, that she would say like really outlandish stuff. Like, one of the things she said was that she like felt connected to like indigenous peoples because she wanted to go out and like sleep in teepees and like shoot arrows. And even when she was talking about like the Black experience, it was in a very like tropey, caricature, and bordering on offensive ways, you know, like offensive ways of like seeing Blackness. It was literally just like the stereotypical things you would expect, which I won't even bother mentioning. So even in her Blackness, she still was like showing her socialization and how she conceived of Blackness. And on top of that as well, like, despite her Black identity or identifying as a Black person, like, she still managed to cause a great deal of harm. Like, when she was filing those fake reports saying that some, like, far-right, like, white nationalist groups were targeting her and posting, like, nooses in her mailbox, in her letterbox, not only is it very terrifying for the other Black people around them who now are on guard and afraid that that's also going to happen to them, and walking about in their everyday life like becoming increasingly wary because this woman's reporting like noose after noose being like mailed in her letterbox, it also demonstrates again that people can be part of a group while simultaneously causing other members of that group harm. And in Rachel Dolezal as well, it isn't just like, again, going back to what I was saying about like sometimes having theoretical discussions and not considering the real life impacts, it isn't just the idea of like conceptually accepting Rachel Dolezal as a Black person. It's also about considering what the real life impacts of that acceptance would be, and what kinds of boundaries need to be drawn around that acceptance and those concessions. And in case of like transracialism, like there's some serious considerations. For example, if we accept the notion that white people can transition into becoming Black people, then what does it mean for EDI, for like equality, diversity and inclusion policies? Does it mean that like scholarships, for example, that have been put aside to right past wrongs, so for example, like a few centuries of Black people not being able to go to university and not being able to have the same level of education has left them behind in lots of
ways educationally and economically, and those scholarships, some of those scholarships are put aside as an attempt to right those historical wrongs, doesn't mean then that a white woman who transitions and becomes a Black woman can therefore use those scholarships or be eligible to receive those scholarships. Because ultimately it would mean that she has on the one hand benefited from racism and then also is benefiting from the policies put in place to essentially right those historical wrongs, because she's basically benefiting then on both ends. And that would extend to discussions around reparations. So reparations for the enslavement, the torture, the subjugation of Black people in the US context for centuries. If reparations ever like are passed or accepted or move forward, does it mean that basically white people can transition to becoming Black people and then be the recipients of reparations specifically designed to right the historical wrongs that Black people have experienced at the hands of white people? So again, there are like real life implications and considerations that go beyond just sort of like people being unaccepting or people being obsessed with like the minutia of like transness. Another example of like real life implications is like, are we to ignore the fact that if transracialness had like taken place, if Rachel had been accepted as a Black person, like would we ignore the fact that structural inequality means that she would be simultaneously be benefiting from that as well as benefiting from being not held accountable to being a beneficiary of racism, if that makes sense. So we know, for example, that white people are much more likely to get loans from banks and to get business loans and to get mortgages. We know that they are more likely to get like employment opportunities. We know that the victims of redlining and gerrymandering are people of color and Black people. We know that police violence disproportionately affects people of color, more specifically Black people in particular. Like, what are we to do with those structural issues where even in the presence of transracialism, like the person, when they are transitioning from white to Black, still is a beneficiary of that structural inequality and also in many ways still upholds it. So I personally think these are very important considerations. I personally also think that these considerations not only hold for like the discussion that I've just had around transracialism, but I also think that they hold for transgenderism as well. In that room that I was in that talk where that person was speaking about the immateriality of sex and the fact that sex is not real and the fact that sex doesn't have any real life consequences. Again, obviously, easy to say from the perspective of the person in the room who holds the most power. Easy to say from the perspective of the person who is simultaneously benefiting from the patriarchy and also simultaneously benefiting from being absolved from having to be held accountable for their participation and upholding and benefiting from the patriarchy. And so again, like when I left that like talk, I mean, luckily the talk I went to next was a completely different setup. It was so engaging. It was so conducive. It was so comfortable. It was great. But what I felt when I left that first room, where I just felt like there are so many conversations that were being stifled. I felt like people weren't being authentic. I felt like people weren't being given the space to express their views in an open and safe way. Not to say, by the way, that I'm an advocate of people just saying offensive, wild, disturbing stuff like just because, like, I don't know if I would say I'm a free speech absolutist. I don't think I am. However, I do think that repressing discussions where clearly the room feels differently is not conducive. It's not conducive to actual structural change, meaningful change, change that is reflected in people's everyday lives and not just like in these particular spaces where they're virtue signaling or they're falling in line because they lack the courage to say what they feel. Ultimately, what any organization or group or movement wants is to make actual changes in people's hearts and minds, like to win people over in a true sense, not in a sense where they're just afraid to say what they feel or they're afraid to sort of like stick their necks out because they fear the social consequences, like real fundamental, like structural changes in them. And when that doesn't take place, again, like I said at the top of the episode, what you get is people doing and saying the right things, but living privately in a completely different way, where they might not speak up and say anything, or they might smile and nod or go along with it. But when it comes to like when it actually matters or when they have agency or power, then that's when the shocks and surprises are going to come in. Because like we just saw in the US elections, you know, you will assume that people believe the things that you believe, that you have consensus, that you have convinced them or you've changed their minds, when in actual fact, they were just clearly afraid to speak out, clearly afraid to like express what they truly felt or felt silenced. And then there's no opportunity to engage in discourse that might change the course of things. Anyway, I think I'm going to stop waffling and end the episode here. Thank you so much for listening to the very end. I appreciate that it's a sensitive topic, and I hope that I approached it in a responsible way. If you thought that there are things that I said, or I phrased things in a way that could have been more thoughtful or conscientious, I'd love for you to drop me an email and let me know. Also, if you listened to the very end and you did like the episode, I'd really appreciate it if you just left me a 5-star review wherever you listen to the podcast. So I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much. Enjoy Cyber Monday. Don't go too crazy, because again, the deals are great, but they're not as great as you think. And also, most of the time, we don't actually need the stuff that we are buying. So indulge in a little bit of like retail therapy, but don't go bust trying to buy the sale or buy the dip, because it honestly is a manufactured sale in many, many respects. But yeah, thank you so much for tuning in. Catch you on the next episode.